political or geopolitical fight. This is a matter of trust between the people. We can trust our democracies. We had an election in Greenland last year, and we had an election in Denmark this year. It's very important to understand there's a close cooperation between the Greenlandic and Danish leader. The American presidents try to split our two countries, but it only made us stand even closer together. So the leader of Greenland's message is very clear that if we had to choose, if Greenland had to choose between United States or Denmark, Greenland will choose Denmark and Europe. So it's very important that you wake up and you see that this not only as a fight for Greenland, but also for the trust we as Greenlanders can have for the Americans and the NATO alliance. So this is not only Greenland being attacked. This is democracy, freedom, and the world order as we know it that's being attacked.
Julie Rademacher, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Chair of WAGUT, an organization, national organization for Greenlanders in Denmark, which helped organize the protest for unity and support for Greenland of thousands this weekend, both in Greenland and Denmark. And we'll cover the Davos summit as well, where President Trump and other world leaders are. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for video news production, digital fellowship. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Do you love rock and roll? Then tune in to KBOO every Friday afternoon at 3 for the Roots of Rock and Roll. Join 45-year host Dale Farr, along with Mike Fisher and Dave Johnson, as they feature music from their collection of hits, near hits, and rare treasures from the first 70 years of rock and roll, only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two Portland police officers were shot and injured near Lloyd Center Monday night. Labor leaders in Minnesota call for a general strike this Friday. And in national news, social justice advocates organize a Free America walkout on the anniversary of Trump's inauguration. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 20, 2026. I'm Eric Leuschner. Two Portland police officers were shot and injured near Lloyd Center on Monday night. The officers were responding to a call about a disturbance near Northeast 21st Avenue and Clackamas Street. They said they found the suspect from that disturbance a few blocks away. He shot at them and then fled. Both police officers were taken to the hospital and are now in stable condition. Police set up a perimeter in the area, shutting down a bunch of roads, but weren't able to find him. Portland police released a photo of the man, a white man in his 30s, with facial hair, wearing a baseball cap, and a black jacket. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson said at a press conference, quote, "This is a stark reminder of the dangers of the job. We're happy to hear the officers are in stable condition, and we wish them a speedy recovery," end quote. Minnesota enters another week of vast uncertainty regarding the large-scale presence of federal immigration agents in the state. With communities still reporting a traumatizing experience, a coalition calls on residents to boycott most activities later this week to get the attention of decision-makers. Mike Moen has more on plans for a general strike.
With federal immigration agents showing no signs of leaving Minnesota, local organizers want to display a large sense of solidarity in condemning ICE enforcement. Major union partners are part of a push for a statewide strike planned for this Friday. Billed as a Day of Truth and Freedom, a delegation of labor offices call on people around the state to, if they can, not go to work, school, or shop on Friday. Mirroring what community voices are saying, union leaders say people in targeted neighborhoods, including workers, are already forced into hiding regardless of their immigration status. Chelsea Globitz-Gabbio of the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation hopes fellow residents take a stand.
We need everyone to pay attention, and we think that on January 23rd, if we all stand together in solidarity and mass mobilization, we can get the attention of the folks who need to step in and make this chaos stop.
Federal officials, including Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, appeared on weekend national talk shows to defend ICE activity in Minnesota. But this month's fatal shooting of Renee Good, along with social media videos showing aggressive ICE enforcement, are leading to more calls for the operation to end. Globitz-Gabbio says they hope to send a message to all political leaders and notable businesses with influence. Retail chains like Target face scrutiny for not being as vocal, even with some workers being detained while on the job. Globitz-Gabbio says business leaders shouldn't worry about retaliation from the Trump administration.
Even like our best and brightest business community leaders who have invested in our community for so long are a part of this pawn game that Trump is playing.
And while they're appealing to all elected officials, unions decry the federal government for reportedly investigating Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey. Officials claim Walz and Frey are impeding the operation with their criticism of ICE activity. But Globitz-Gabbio says false labels are being applied to the pushback. She says the reality is people are buying whistles to alert their neighbors and film ICE arrests with their phones, noting it's rooted in peace, love, and determination.
It is true grit of the folks that are showing up. The people who live in these neighborhoods, these are not paid protesters. We cannot understate enough the amount of community support and neighborhood support that has been built.
This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
It's the one-year anniversary of President Trump's second inauguration, and across Oregon and the country, the social justice group Women's March is calling for a Free America walkout. It's the same group that organized the Women's March on Washington in 2021. In Portland, the organizers planned a rally and march for this afternoon, calling on participants to reject fascism and walk towards a free America. On their website, they write, quote, "Our elected officials have failed to take effective action to squash this regime. They continue to allow the illegal takeover of our country from within and the continued violent terrorism of the people of this nation and our neighboring sovereign nations. No one is above the law of this nation. We demand this madness end," end quote. Demonstrations were planned in a number of Oregon cities, including Baker City, Bandon, Bend, Corvallis, Eugene, Hood River, Port Orford, Prineville, and Sherwood. Internet-based scams are becoming more commonplace, and nonprofits in Oregon are taking action to protect older adults in the state by promoting digital literacy. They say while it can be intimidating to learn new technology, it can also be fun and an antidote to isolation. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
In the wake of increasing rates of digital scams, two Oregon nonprofits are promoting digital literacy in older adults, hoping to prevent losses and improve their quality of life. Nationally, internet crime losses hit a record $16.6 billion in 2024. Beth Mitchell is with Age Plus, an Oregon-based nonprofit that addresses the opportunities and challenges of the state's aging population. She says a fear of scams can prevent some older adults from adopting new technology, calling digital literacy a public health issue vital to preventing isolation.
Whether it's accessing resources or connecting with your loved ones, being connected is really beneficial when people have the opportunity to learn how to use the digital skills and to build their confidence.
There are many resources available for people to grow their digital skills, adds Mitchell, including through Age Plus or public libraries. She reminds people that while it can be challenging to learn new things, it can also be fun and empowering if you take your time and get support where you need it. Mitchell explains older adults can avoid fraud by verifying a message's origin and checking the email or phone number. She advises calling the sender at a known official number to confirm requests. If the contact details don't match, it's likely a scam.
There is never an instance where you have to immediately act or immediately give any of your information. You can always take a moment.
Last week, Age Plus, in partnership with Oregon Consumer Justice, launched a comic that highlights scammer red flags and gives people tools to grow technical skills. This is the fourth issue of its Consumer Confidence Comics series. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A provision in the fiscal year 2026 federal funding bill that would have shielded pesticide manufacturers from lawsuits regarding non-disclosure of product hazards has been removed. Democrats led this effort, which consumer advocacy groups described as a setback for chemical manufacturers. Terry D. reports.
A provision denying people the right to sue chemical companies for non-disclosure of potential health hazards has been removed from a federal measure to fund the Environmental Protection Agency. In early 2024, Indiana House lawmakers introduced similar legislation, but the measure failed to pass. The bill attempted to narrow the definition of toxic PFAS chemicals to exempt many of those used by manufacturers. Jay Feldman with the nonprofit Beyond Pesticides says companies should be held accountable when consumers are harmed.
This is a basic tenet in our society, and the industry is really trying to take advantage of the fact that the authority of federal agencies that are mandated to protect public health and safety are being weakened.
The federal provision, which opponents refer to as the, quote, Cancer Gag Act, was removed by Democrats during budget hearings in the House Appropriations Committee. After years of large jury settlements linked to the common weed killer Roundup, chemical giants like Bayer have been lobbying for protection from what they call, quote, scientifically unsound lawsuits, Feldman explains. Opponents of the provision argued it would have prevented states from restricting the use of harmful cancer-causing chemicals. So-called failure to warn bills that limit citizens' ability to seek compensation for harm caused by pesticides are expected in several state legislatures this year. Feldman says chemical companies are working to weaken both federal and state regulations while also claiming these regulations adequately protect the public.
Here's a chemical industry that has sought to dismantle regulatory programs, and then they point to those very programs as the protection that the public should feel comfortable with as protecting their health and their environment.
Feldman says while the provision was removed from the federal funding bill, it could be attached to any legislation moving through Congress, including a revised farm bill. The current version expires in September. I'm Terry D. reporting.
Federal prosecutors threaten protesters who disrupted a Minnesota church service as others rally nationwide to mark MLK Jr. Day in the first year of Trump's second term. Watchdogs raise concerns on Nebraska's ballot initiative process and Nevada's voter roll challenges. That story and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The Department of Justice will come down hard on anybody who tries to impede or intimidate somebody in a place of worship or a police officer or an ICE officer. It's just not going to happen in this administration.
Justice Department advisor Alina Haba warns it may prosecute protesters who disrupted a St. Paul church over the weekend. The protests targeted Pastor David Easterwood, who's also the acting director of the local ICE office. On Friday, the Justice Department subpoenaed Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, saying they may have obstructed federal law enforcement after the killing of Renee Good by an ICE officer. The White House also put two airborne battalions on standby for a possible deployment to the city. President Donald Trump says he will not, for the moment, invoke the Insurrection Act that would let him use the active duty troops to enforce civilian law. The Prime Minister of Norway sent a message to Trump calling for him to back away from tariffs punishing the EU for not supporting a takeover of Greenland. Trump replied he no longer felt obliged to make peace since Norway didn't give him the Nobel Peace Prize. The prize is awarded by the Nobel Committee, not the government of Norway. 1 year after Trump's second inauguration and just days after Martin Luther King's birthday, people gathered for more than 500 protests around the country. Catherine Pollack with Engaged Defenders for Democracy says they are fighting for the rule of law and for corporations and billionaires to get out of politics.
We the people are the ones who are giving our power to our elected officials, and they're supposed to represent us. That's how our government works. But right now, corporations are dictating how some of our elected officials are voting.
A new coalition of Nebraska voters says state lawmakers lawmakers are subverting ballot initiatives even after they've passed, weakening voter-approved plans for higher minimum wage and paid sick leave. Don Essink, with Respect Nebraska Voters, says they want to make it harder for lawmakers to pass any legislation changing an initiative after it's approved. She says it's wrong to undermine the will of voters who've successfully used the ballot initiative process.
We've been living with the work really hard, pass the initiative, get it on the ballot, vote for it overwhelmingly, and then boom, the legislature, the governor, both decide that they don't like what was passed.
A local effort to challenge voter rolls is concerning pro-democracy advocates in Nevada. The effort, called the Pigpen Project, has a website that says it's training volunteers to use a web-based tool to spot irregularities and inconsistencies in voter registrations. But Carrie Dermick, with the nonprofit All Voting is Local, says voter challenges are only legal if backed by specific, firsthand knowledge, not the cyber dragnet Pigpen uses.
Personal knowledge is defined as firsthand knowledge through an experience or observation of facts on the ground under penalty of perjury. So our concern is, what tactics are they using to get that personal knowledge on these challenged voters?
Nevada election officials say the current system already effectively verifies voter eligibility and removes those who have moved or died. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Cable Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 30 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 49. Today in history, in 1981, Iran releases 52 American hostages 20 minutes after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as president. The quote of the day is from surrealist American film director David Lynch, born this day in 1946. He said, quote, "There are so many clues and feelings in the world that it makes a mystery, and a mystery means there's a puzzle to be solved. Once you think like that, you're hooked on probably finding a meaning. And there's many avenues in life where we're given little indications that the mystery can one day be solved. We get little proofs, not the big proof, but the little proofs that keep us searching." Tribal Mental Health and Addiction Services were thrown into upheaval last week when the Trump administration canceled and then uncanceled federal funding for these programs last week. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders are among those raising concerns about the stability of mental health and substance abuse services. That's after a temporary major cut in federal funding last week. Chuck Kornbach reports.
The White House announced roughly $2 billion in cuts to the SAMHSA, or Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. The government said the money no longer aligned with President Trump's public health agenda. Then, about 24 hours later, and without explanation, the grants were restored. The Ho-Chunk Nation is one of about 2,000 organizations that would have lost funding. Ho-Chunk President John Greender says last week's cuts, had they held, would have been on top of other reductions announced a year ago that were only partly restored.
Those never came back online completely, especially those who work close with the program.
Greender says the Indian Health Service has also lost staff nationwide. He says the uncertainty not only harms indigenous communities, which he calls America's most vulnerable populations.
It is dealing with the most vulnerable populations within a vulnerable population. We are working on mental health issues. We are working with addiction, domestic abuse, and all the, you know, social determinants of health.
Greender says overall the Ho-Chunk Nation is providing a good level of services, but only after greater partnering with the state of Wisconsin and some nearby counties. The question for some organizations is whether the Trump administration will try again sometime to make major cuts in federal dollars. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Indigenous students and families are concerned about rising costs as the U.S. Department of Education resumes wage garnishment for federal student loans in default. The Mountain West News Bureau's Daniel Spalding has more.
The Department of Education started to send notices to borrowers whose loans have gone unpaid for more than 9 months. Employers can withhold up to 15% of disposable income without a court order. This policy may hit indigenous communities especially hard. Higher education analysts say that about 40% of Native borrowers default on their federal loans, and many carry balances longer after graduation than other groups. Nez Perce tribal member Sienna Rubin, who graduated from the University of Idaho in 2021, says wage garnishment adds another financial burden to Native families already stretched thin.
I feel like student loans obviously come last, because are you eating them? Are they, are they feeding you? Are they housing you? Are they doing any of this stuff?
Rubin also says that Indigenous alumni often have the additional responsibility of supporting family members. I'm Daniel Spalding.
More than a dozen tribal governments have formed the Alliance of Sovereign Tribes of Southeast Alaska. The new partnership promotes a unified approach to addressing regional tribal concerns while acknowledging each tribe's individual differences. Gloria Burns is the president of the Ketchikan Indian Community. She says the new partnership has already improved communication between the region's tribes.
As we communicate, then we're going to partner with each other. And when we partner with each other, then we're creating real movement and change with each other.
Albert Smith is the mayor of the Metlakatla Indian Community, the only reservation in Alaska. He says there has not been an established partnership of Southeast Alaska tribes in more than 20 years.
The importance is tribes helping tribes, working together for a common goal of the betterment of our region and indigenous peoples of our region.
Other tribal governments in the alliance include the Craig Tribal Association, the Organized Village of Cake, and the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
More people in Washington state are voicing their opinions through protest, and with the increased presence of federal law enforcement across the country, volunteer peacekeepers are stepping up. A Washington nonprofit has been training peacekeepers for years and says their services are in high demand. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Amid the increased presence of federal law enforcement across the country, demand is growing for peacekeepers at protests and other events, and one Washington state nonprofit is stepping up to meet the need. Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane has been training volunteers to help maintain a nonviolent atmosphere at protests and other events for years. But now, Joe Stussy with Pajal says demand is increasing for volunteers to liaison with police, help direct crowds, and serve as a buffer between attendees and hecklers or counter-protesters.
We never respond to aggression with aggression. And frequently, event organizers have a strict non-engagement with counter-protesters that we can model. We're there to be unflappable and to be the calmest people in the room.
Pajal's peacekeepers prioritize working with groups who they say are being targeted by people in power. These days, they say that largely means supporting Latino and immigrant-led organizations facing increased federal immigration enforcement in the state, as well as queer and trans communities. James McShane has been a volunteer peacekeeper for 9 months. He says volunteers are asked to attend a range of gatherings, including book signings and community events. He says now's the time for people to show up and support causes they care about.
Sometimes people worry about counter protesters and their safety. So I at least hope that my presence encourages even one person to feel safe enough to come out.
Volunteer peacekeepers go through a 4-hour training covering general do's and don'ts for practicing nonviolent conflict de-escalation. Organizers say requests for training are now coming from groups across the region, and Pajal's is in the process of expanding the program. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Tens of thousands of Cubans demonstrated Friday outside the U.S. Embassy in Havana to decry the killing of 32 Cuban officers in Venezuela and demand that the U.S. government release former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. They crowded into the José Martí anti-imperialist plaza across from the embassy in a rally organized by the Cuban government. The demonstration was a show of popular strength after U.S. President Donald Trump recently demanded that Cuba make a deal with him before it's too late. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel shook hands with members of the crowd before speaking to them. He said, quote, "No one here surrenders. The current emperor of the White House and his infamous Secretary of State haven't stopped threatening me," end quote. The 32 officers were part of Maduro's security detail. They were killed during the raid on his residence January 3rd. After the president's speech, the demonstration transitioned into a parade. A line of people holding pictures of the 32 officers killed led the crowd. The crowd yelled, quote, "Down with imperialism, Cuba will prevail," end quote. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says the pro-Russia orientation of President Trump's Ukraine policy is well known. At every turn in the war, Trump has refused to criticize or confront Vladimir Putin. As one European commentator puts it, the worst thing that could happen to Putin would be the demise of Trump. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The New York Times published a year-end story about the unraveling of the U.S.-Ukraine partnership that had developed under Joe Biden. The author interviewed around 300 people, mostly people in U.S. policymaking circles. Though the analysis differs little from what I and other foreign policy specialists have been saying about the Trump-Russia relationship, namely that the Trump administration has refused to give Ukraine the weapons to withstand Russian advances and has been consistently partial to Russian interests, it sheds a deeper light on the bureaucratic infighting that Trump and Pete Hegseth have presided over. It's not a pretty picture. For example, quote, "Mr. Trump had scant ideological commitment. His pronouncements and determinations were often shaped by the last person he spoke to, by how much respect he felt the Ukrainian and Russian leaders had shown him, by what caught his eye on Fox News. Policy was forged in the clash of bitterly warring camps." Another example from the Times. "A cold wind and what one senior military officer called a de facto anti-Ukraine policy swept through the Pentagon. Time and again, Mr. Hegseth and his advisors undermined, sidelined, or silenced frontline generals and administration officials sympathetic to Ukraine." The president is variously pictured in the Times account as a wobbler, an ill-informed outsider, and a leader who bends in the direction of the last person he spoke with. When it comes to Russia, Trump early on claimed that "Russia is mine, not yours," meaning that he, not his envoys, would determine Russia policy. They could deal with Ukraine and Europe. But Trump apparently delegated considerable authority to Hegseth on weapons deliveries to Ukraine, ensuring that these would be terminated, including around $3.5 billion left over from the Biden years. This background helps us to understand the administration's position on the key issues that are obstructing a Russia-Ukraine peace agreement. Take, for example, Russia's resistance to a ceasefire in advance of negotiations, which Trump says he understands. As CNN puts it, quote, "No ceasefire then means no referendum in Ukraine's eastern territories, which Ukraine demands. And no referendum could mean no territorial concessions from Ukraine, and ultimately no deal, which gives Russia more time to attack." Or consider where Trump stands on the 20-point peace plan put forward by President Zelensky. On one hand, Trump seems to support a legal U.S. commitment to Ukraine's defense, though without U.S. troops on the ground. On the other, Trump says nothing about Russia's daily bombing, nor has he ever challenged Putin's territorial ambitions or Putin's provocations of NATO members. He just wants to end the war. Nothing else seems to matter. That pattern is relevant to the most important thing Ukraine wants these days, a firm security guarantee from the U.S. to deter a future Russian attack. As Philip Gordon, Kamala Harris's national security advisor, recently wrote, however, such a guarantee would be meaningless coming from Trump, for many reasons, one of which is his disdainful view of NATO. In short, it is hard to believe that Trump would honor a security pledge to Ukraine. Imagine, for example, that those little green men, Russian soldiers without insignia, who fought in the Donbass region before the current war, suddenly reappeared there after a peace settlement. Does anyone believe Trump would react with force against them? Trump has chosen to ignore the latest displays of Putin's obstinacy, Putin's rejection of a European military presence in Ukraine after a settlement, and Russia's use of a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile in attacks on Ukraine. A Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman warned that, quote, "the deployment of military units, military facilities, warehouses, and other infrastructure of Western countries on Ukrainian territory will be classified as foreign intervention, posing a direct threat to the security of not only Russia, but also other European countries." And she added, "all such units and facilities will be considered legitimate combat targets of the Russian armed forces." The firing of the Oreshnik hypersonic missile close to Russia's border with Poland was surely intended to send that very message, that European forces stationed in Ukraine would be fair game. The missile may also have been intended to let the Trump administration know that Russia's bombing of Ukraine is unrelenting, so long as its terms for peace are not met. In a December 28th interview with Reuters, Trump said of Putin, "I think he's ready to make a deal. I think Ukraine is less ready to make a deal." Asked why that's so, Trump responded, "Zelensky." Europeans know better. The noted Russia analyst Anders Asland has written a scathing review of the numerous times Trump has bowed to Putin, going back to his first visit to Moscow in 1987. Asland's review concludes, quote, "The worst thing that could happen to Putin, apart from his own ouster, would be the demise of Trump." I'm Mel Gertal for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 20, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Lizard. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Simone Perez, Terry D., and Suzanne Potter. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Weishner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Today I'm featuring the second half of my conversation with author, speaker, entrepreneur, and wearer of many more hats, Jamie Workman. Jamie is most recently the co-author, along with Environmental Defense Fund Executive Director Amanda Leland, of the new book, Sea Change, Unlikely Allies and a Success Story of Oceanic Proportions. Sea Change highlights the underreported